Hello, and welcome. Hope you're enjoying the summit this year, and welcome to this talk today. As doesn't actually got it up there, but looking at optimizing outcomes for customers in a low interest world. Today, before we go into it, I just wanted a few housekeeping things. If you want to ask a question, if you could step up to the microphone because it's being recorded, and say your name, that would be great. Don't forget to fill your feedback in on the app. And most importantly, there's a competition running. It's coming to a close, so get your competition entries in the next hour or so to do that. So today we have both Mark and Nick who are presenting today about... So Mark has sort of worked in the Australian financial services industry for over 25 years and is currently head of the ALM at AMP. Over the past 20 years, Mark has made a significant contribution to the development of a number of innovative products and service offerings, and today he's going to be sort of talking about some adaptions to those. Nick has just recently graduated from UNSW in 2016 and has worked as an analyst in the pricing team of AMP for the past 12 months and previously worked in the marketing role at MetLife. So his work interests include financial modelling, investment research and reinsurance. So today I welcome the two and I look forward to the presentation.
Just a few words of introduction first. Retirement incomes is a complex sort of topic to discuss, and you know, I'm no expert on retirement incomes. And I think the sort of topics that have been discussed over the last day or so sort of make it pretty clear that it's an even more complex sort of area than just the financial modelling aspects that we do a fair bit of work on in our area. You need to be able to articulate and understand the sort of values and sociological principles that that are used to, you know, try to help society deal with a whole lot of problems and challenges and individuals, real human beings. So what we're presenting here is really we're not trying to present a silver bullet solution to any particular problem, just explore a few issues and some potential solutions that are those issues that are probably amplified in a low interest rate world. So we think that some of the ways that we're thinking about optimising our customer outcomes may become more interesting to customers if interest rates remain low for a long period of time. So I'll just sort of hand over to Nick to sort of give us the overview of our talk and some of the background that we've been considering.
Okay, so broadly speaking, our presentation is divided into three key topics. So first we're going to look at the recent context. In this section, we're going to look at the impact low interest rates have had on global life insurance markets and also what the impact they've had on Australian retirees. And next, we'll move on to the current outlook. And in this section, we're going to look at whether interest rates will remain low and if they do, what the implications will be for retirees. Finally, we'll move on to some potential solutions. And in this section, we're going to look at how two non-conventional products stack up against some conventional products which are popular in the Australian retirement system today. So the period since the 2007 global financial crisis has seen a long-term unprecedented decline in interest rates. And this has only been exacerbated in recent years due to the economic slowdown in China. And from a life insurance company's perspective, low interest rates generally lead to a deterioration in profitability. And the extent to which this occurs is driven by two key factors. And the first of these is the level of guarantees. And this is in terms of both nominal guaranteed rate and the volume of guaranteed business. Obviously, when investment returns fall, returns on assets fall, and this results in gains to customers funded by losses to the insurer. The second is duration mismatch, which is because in many markets, insurers have very long-term liabilities, and they can't find assets of sufficient duration to match these liabilities. And as a result, this means that their liabilities are a lot more sensitive to interest rates than assets. And as a result, when interest rates fall, the degree to which liabilities increase is much greater than the extent to which assets increase. And so what we've done with this map over on the top left here is we've taken a report from Moody's Investor Services, and we've looked at the level of risk in each in life insurance markets around the globe. And basically, they've classified life insurers into countries into five risk buckets. And the topmost bucket of these is the very high-risk bucket. And these are the insurers with the greatest duration mismatch and with investment returns already close to or below the guaranteed rate. And an example of a country in this situation is Germany, and they're experiencing severe losses due to a high volume of guaranteed business sold in the early 2000s, and that's actually allocated to participating products. And as we move down, we get to the high-risk bucket. And in this bucket, there's a less, there's more moderate duration gap. However, investment returns are already quite close or below guaranteed rates. And an example of a country in this situation is Japan, and we're going to look at that in more detail in the coming slides. And then moving further down, we have the moderate to very low risk buckets. And so the moderate risk buckets, they have more well-matched liabilities duration-wise, and they're readily able to lower guaranteed rates. And as a result of this, losses are limited. While looking at the very low risk and low risk buckets, the risk of losses is pretty minimal due to interest rates, just due to a low volume of business or due to risk sharing features such as bonus clawbacks and adjustable guarantee rates. And so with this in mind, as you can see, Australia is in the very low risk bucket. And with this in mind, I wanted to move on to the current financial position of the Australian retirement income system. And at a broad level, our retirement system is quite exposed to risk in a low interest rate scenario, since effectively customers bear all the interest rate risk. And in it's already facing quite severe structural challenges. And central to this is the fact that our population is rapidly aging, and this is resulting in an increase in the dependency ratio, with public retirement benefits increasing as a proportion of tax revenues. And this comes at a time when many retirees are already struggling, are already facing challenges financially, with only 53% of couples and 22% of singles anticipated to achieve ASFA's comfortable lifestyle standard, although this is quite a questionable standard, to be honest, because 70% of people aren't actually expected to achieve this level of lifestyle in their entire life. And to put this into perspective also, when the first age pensions were introduced, the age at which they commenced was around age 60, which compared to a life expectancy at the time of 55. And so now that we've sort of covered off the recent context and introduced the context of our presentation, I thought it would be interesting to have a look at Japan. And Japan provides a particularly useful case study in this regard because they've been grappling with ultra-low interest rates for around 20 years now, and they've had a substantial volume of guaranteed business as well. So to get started, we'll look at the key reasons why Japan was so exposed to risk in a low interest rate scenario. And the key reason for this is was the substantial volumes of guaranteed business sold during the boom years of the 1980s. And to back these liabilities, the Japanese life insurance industry invested heavily in equities and property. And when the Japanese market turned in the early 1990s, this set them up for a catastrophic contraction. And this was combined... This was made worse by the fact that significant deregulation had occurred in the late 1980s, resulting in an intensification in competition. And so, as a result of this increased competition and a rapid decline in confidence in the banking sector, which rapidly spread to the life insurance sector, this saw surrenders soar. And as a result of this, insurers which were already burdened with excessive guarantees and deflated asset portfolios were forced to sell liquid assets at distressed prices. And the situation got so bad that, in fact, between 1998 and 2013, the industry never returned above its cost of equity for a full in each and every year. And at one point, seven life insurers went bankrupt in the space of 5 years. And in response to the deteriorating situation, government and industry took a number of actions. And central to this was the fact that they lowered guaranteed rates on new business to reflect the deteriorating market environment, while legislation was also introduced to allow them to reduce unrealistic guaranteed rates on their legacy portfolios. In addition to this, insolvent insurers were granted special restructuring provisions, and this involved applying a 10% haircut on policy reserves backing their guarantees, as well as... and they also received capital injections from an industry-backed policyholder protection fund. In addition to this, they also shifted their product mix towards shorter-term and non-guaranteed products such as medical, cancer, and long-term care insurance. But despite this, the Japanese market is still quite high risk and it's burdened by stagnant asset markets and an ageing population. And despite all the efforts they've made, they're in a still pretty bad situation. So now that we've covered off the recent context, let's look at the current outlook. And in this section, we're going to look at whether interest rates will remain low and if they do, what the implications will be for retirees. So when we're considering if interest rates are going to remain low, there's two key questions we have to ask. And the first of these is what actually constitutes a low interest rate. So what we've done is we've looked at interest rates over the past 5,000 years, and what you can see is that short-term rates in the US are at historically low levels, comparable only to the Depression era and World War II, although long rates are actually quite close to their long-run average level. And the second key thing we have to realise here is that the extent to which interest rates were abnormally high in the 70s and 80s was far more extreme than the extent to which they're low today. And as a result of this, if we anchor our expectations as to what constitutes a normal interest rate to this period, it's going to make interest rates today seem far more low than they really are. And the second key question we have to ask is what are the drivers of prevailing low interest rates? And so we've compiled a list of four key factors we believe are driving this trend. And it's by no means exhaustive, but I'll go through each factor one by one. And so the first is low inflation rates. And obviously this is because since the most recent financial quarter, inflation was below 2% since 2014. And as a result, the Reserve Bank has had incentive to hold interest rates low to stimulate economic growth and prevent the emergence of a deflationary environment. Next, we have Australia's economic transition as Chinese demand for Australian commodities falls away and it shifts from a more capital-intensive mining activity towards a more labour-intensive service-based economy. And as this occurs, this has resulted in slow wage growth, which despite boosting employment, has in aggregate resulted in declines in productivity growth and inflation, and as a result of that, the demand for debt has reduced, which has further pushed interest rates down. And on the flip side, we have changing demographics, because as the population ages, we find older people tend to save more money. They're not earning money. They don't have young children to support, usually. And as a result of that, the supply of savings is increased greatly, which further pushes down interest rates. And then finally, we have household debt. And household debt's at a record 125% of GDP at the moment. And as a result of that, that's created political pressure to hold interest rates low to prevent a proliferation of bad debt in the financial system. But ultimately, we can't really say whether interest rates will remain low. It's very difficult to determine. In recent months, due to political developments, we've seen interest rates increase quite markedly. But what is certain is that if they do remain low, the challenges for both retirees and government is going to be challenging and far-reaching. And so what we've done in this slide is we've looked at potential scenarios that could eventuate in a low interest rate environment. And up the top, what we've done is we've looked at the typical composition of a moderately defensive and growth portfolio in the Australian superannuation industry. And then below that, in pale blue, we've projected out our assumed returns for each asset class and compared them to historical benchmark indices, which were incepted around the year 2000. And what we can see is that under the current interest rate scenario, which is around a 2.5% yield on 10-year government bonds, that our investment returns are already slightly below historic levels. And in a low interest rate scenario, this could turn out really badly because these returns could drop by as much as 2.5% if risk premiums don't rise to compensate for the fall in interest rates. And as we'll see later on in our retiree case study where we use this financial data to perform projections, this will have a marked impact on the way retirees will be affected in retirement and the way they make decisions and what sort of products would be appealing to them. And so in this slide, we've found an online survey and it tracks a small group of surveyees in the US and what they think of the low interest rate policy there. And what we can see surprisingly is that a small majority of retirees support a low interest rate policy and they believe the economic benefits outweigh the costs. Although clearly this is much, they support it to much less extent as do non-retirees. And this is in spite of the challenging decisions such a policy is forcing them to make. And we can see a detailed breakdown of these on the right. And broadly speaking, they fall into four main categories. And the first three of these are pretty obvious, being to save more, spend less, and work longer. While the fourth involves sort of chasing yield by investing in more volatile asset classes, as well as seeking out alternative sources of return, such as infrastructure and private equity. And with this in mind, we intend to use the rest of the presentation to explore how life insurers can help customers think differently about how they save for their retirement by focusing on this fourth goal. And the first thing that comes to mind is the fact that life insurers can use their purchasing power and scale to obtain investment guarantees on a wholesale basis and then pass these on to retail customers for a small fee. And what this allows customers to do is chase yield with minimal downside risk. And there's already products in the market like this today. And the second thing is they can develop products which pool longevity risk, which we refer to as mortality pooling products in this presentation. And basically this involves allocating a portion of their pension savings into a pool of money which is used to fund survival bonuses for surviving members of the pool. And with this in mind, I'll hand over to Mark now, who will do a case study, retiree case study.
So Nick sort of set the scene for what sort of environment are retirees actually facing in Australia. And I think one of the key points that he was making was that in Australia, most retirees are bearing, or interest rate risk is actually borne by the retirees. So they're also bearing a lot of idiosyncratic mortality risk, or the risk that they might, you know, die before their money, or after their, or, you know, they might run out of money before they die, as well as the. So what we thought we'd do is just sort of explore those two concepts for how they might be able to increase their investment risk and get a bigger share of the risk premium, and also how they might be able to pool their mortality experience to try and take away some of that idiosyncratic longevity risk. So we thought we'd look at a particular retiree, maybe typical retiree, Jane Jones, just to give some context to some of the projections that we show later. So Jane's 62 years old. She's a recently widowed, so she's single, and she is an engineer, and she's currently working part-time and has a reasonably good income as a part-time worker. Now, she's already made the most significant response to a low interest rate environment that she's actually planning to work till she's 70. She's got some only $340,000 in super currently, so she's planning to work another sort of 8 years. And she's got a house that she owns. She'd like to leave that house to the kids, or at least the monetary value of that house to the kids, potentially buy a new car. And she's read the ASFA website and has studied the budget that they've put onto the website there, and thinks that she would like to be able to live this comfortable lifestyle of $43,000 a year, which would get her a new car once in a while. So this is where, you know, it's very hard. I mean, I'm a man, I'm not an engineer, I'm certainly not 62 years old, so it's really hard for me to sort of talk about how Jane feels about things, so I'm actually going to give you my perspective on the sort of things that she should be considering, but may not be the right thing. So there's four product types that we're actually going to be thinking about as potential solutions for Jane. The first is the traditional allocated pension, which pretty much everyone accesses in Australia. It's a generic investment account. The person is exposed to investment risk. You know, you have to take a minimum amount out every year. The income is tax-free in that environment. The investment income is tax-free, as well as the income that she's drawing out of the allocated pension. We look at that across three different criteria. One is the longevity protection. Clearly, that sort of product is providing minimal longevity protection. there's no investment protection in the standard sort of offering, but there is an explicit fee level that's reasonably cheap, right, compared to some of the other products that we sell, so or people in the market sell, particularly us at AMP. The second type of product is an allocated pension enhanced with a GMAB, or guaranteed minimum asset benefit. The idea of that product is that you can take on more investment risk and guarantee that you'll get the money you originally put in back in 10 years' time. There's a multitude of variants of this product. The one that we're going to look at is just a 10-year guarantee, which locks in any positive returns along the way. The third type of product is this mortality pooling concept. Now, I know Mercer have one of these products on the market. We're not modelling the exactly the same version of that. We've sort of simplified it a little bit. But we have looked at, you know, a number of different variants of that type of approach, and we'll sort of show you some of the outcomes from that. And the fourth version is the life annuity. So the life annuity is something that's back in the 80s sold quite a bit in the Australian market when interest rates were in the 13-14% zone, and as sales in that product have decreased over the years, albeit Challenger has started to see some significant increases in their sales over the last year or so. The life annuity is something that has no explicit fees, so it's quite attractive in the advisor market from that point of view. It provides longevity protection, so you're guaranteed to get that income for the rest of your life as long as the provider stays solvent and is able to meet those payments. And also you've got investment protection on that, on those sorts of products. Importantly, what we're doing here when we do this comparison is we've assumed that Jane is a moderately defensive type investor. So in the allocated pension projections, we've assumed that she's investing in a moderately defensive fund. In order to make that compare that fund with the GMAB enhancement there, we've had to assume that it's in a what's called a volatility controlled fund. So it's got a dynamic asset allocation that's algorithmically based that enables the provider to control the volatility on the fund, and so they can write a guarantee on it. We're not going to go into the details of that, but it is a sort of important assumption. And when Jane does invest in this account with the GMAB, we've assumed that she's going to increase her risk appetite, so invest in a growth fund with this volatility control on it, and then add a guarantee. So on to the next slide. We've just got a bit more of the detail here. So we're assuming she's going to invest $340,000 into the allocated pension in moderately defensive. The investment fee we've assumed is 40 basis points. That's a typo there. So I've got a few comments to make about that later. When she's investing in the guarantee, the allocated pension with the guarantee, she's going to invest the same amount, and then she's going to put a guarantee on it for 10 years. And the guarantee fee we've assumed is 2.05%. That's including the investment fee. And so after the 10-year period, the fee drops to 40 basis points. Now, these are not prices that you can get on the market at this point in time. We've made a sort of good guess about what we think might need to happen for these sort of products to really get some traction. So then the life annuity, we've assumed that she's investing $400,000 at age 70. So she invests for another, SGC for another 8 years, gets to age 70 and buys an annuity. We've had to make some wild assumptions about what income she would get from that annuity. And if you'd like to ask questions, Nick's got some answers for that afterwards. And then the final one is the mortality pool. So this is, I think, quite a complex product to explain, but essentially what we've done is to say she's got $340,000 and she's going to invest $290,000 in an allocated pension and then take $50,000 and put it into this mortality pool. And the way the pool would work is that she has no access to that money until she's 80, 85. From that age, she starts to receive a capital drawdown from there of 5% a year. If she dies or surrenders, she loses access to that money. So that money, the $50,000, would go into the pool and be distributed to the survivors in the pool. We've assumed that the pool is all female non-smokers, so it's all identical. Now, I know that there's a range of different ways you can structure that product. You can make it so that you can you only lose 10% of the money when you die or retire or withdraw, or you can make an income distribution from the pool that's sort of based on actuarial annuity values and things like this. But we tried to do something that was fairly simple, and the real concept here is that an individual has to, when they're buying a product like that, they have to have some sort of sense of solidarity with the pool that they're entering into, and so that they're comfortable giving up that money or some part of that money to the pool in order to ensure they've got some income coming through if they do actually live to an older age. In this example, we've assumed they give up 100% of the $50,000. Right, so we're still going on. Okay. So, I guess I've alluded to it here is that there is actually a bit of different thinking that's required. You wouldn't be able to go and do any of this in this current market as an individual at this point in time. There's a few changes that would have to happen. But the idea is that, people would need to be able to choose the level of risk that they want. They want to be able to transform that risk in some way. So the industry needs to be able to provide products that allow customers to transform the risk. In this case, we're showing how an individual could transform their investment risk from being just a defensive type investor to someone who's got a growth asset allocation and is picking up a little bit more risk premium and hopefully paying less than that risk premium in guarantee fees. That the individuals have to have some sense of solidarity with the pool, that the mortality pool that they're potentially going to invest in. People would need to start thinking that it's more important that Joe Blow down the road, who's done similar jobs to me over my lifetime, deserves my money more than my children deserve it, in order for me to get an income when I'm older. I don't know how realistic that assumption is, but it is something that would have to actually happen. The business models would have to change a little bit. Insurers would need to see a sustainable competitive advantage in providing guarantees. So everyone who's involved in the funds management industry would know there's a lot of margin pressure on straight funds management products at the moment. That margin pressure is not going to go away. Potentially it's going to get worse. Hence, we've assumed the fees will fall to 40 bips. And that would cover your platform administration fees and all the other, add-ons. And that there is actually sustainable competitive advantage in having a guarantee that you charge, an appropriate fee for. The obvious question is, well, how do you get all of those fees out of the system for doing an administration service? Well, you do wonder what Google or Amazon could do, and are they more natural competitors or providers of that sort of service? Finally is engagement. And this is really hard. How do you actually communicate with clients in a way that they would actually want to make all these risk trade-offs, understand these risk trade-offs, and be involved in this process? And this is something I think is really, really hard. I'm going to talk to a few things that make sense to me, but probably don't make sense to normal human beings, and potentially, you know, other people need to work out how to do this better. So what we're showing here is some sort of outcomes from just the GMAB product. So if you look here, this is the probability that you're going to be able to provide this income of $43,000 per annum after a land for age pension. And you can see that the probability when you're just using an allocated pension, it falls off pretty steeply from about 85. You see the median outcome. So what we've done is run a simulation with 1,000 different investment scenarios with sort of a risk premium built in and zero interest rates. And what you see here is that the GMAB, that's where the guarantee stops. Okay, so she gets to age 72 and she's receiving most of her income from the allocated pension with the GMAB on it and a small amount of age pension all the way up to here. With no guarantee, she'd be able to get the sort of $43,000 to about age 89. With the guarantee, she can extend that out to age 92 in the median scenario from these 1,000 scenarios that we looked at. And we'd sort of shown the annuity as providing the income $43,000 per annum for life here. That's a pretty heroic assumption. We could put it down here or up here. It sort of depends on what the market actually does. But we weren't really trying to make a pitch for something other than an annuity. Wanted to really talk about this risk transformation concept. So with no guarantee, she's invested in a moderately defensive fund. At the end of the 10-year guarantee period, the sort of distribution of asset values that she would have is this, under this black line there. So, you know, the median's around here somewhere, about $350,000. This is after a couple of years of withdrawals. By putting on the guarantee and investing in a higher risk assets, she's able to chop off, you know, this sort of lower end of the distribution and pick up some upside, okay? And the reason she's able to do that is because the risk premiums that we've assumed are greater than the guarantee fee. These are the sorts of projections that I particularly like. So you can see here that this dark black line there is the allocated pension with no guarantee. That's the average path. Okay, so we've taken the sort of average path and shown it there. With the guarantee on, it's slightly higher because she's got a slightly higher, risk premium coming through. This dotted blue line here is where the, you know, asset values would be if in the worst case scenario. So this is the one where the asset value at the end of the 10 years is at its lowest. So you see that up until that time, the guarantee is really not effective. There is no guarantee. But at the time, when she gets to age 72, the guarantee kicks in. And so her account balance goes up to here and she starts to track down on the median. And so her worst outcomes are here at around, running out of money around age 90. With this enormous upside, right? So these may be unrealistic sort of outcomes, but, you know, if she's got a goal to leave an inheritance to the family apart from the house, she can start to access this upside from the equity markets and still sort of have a reasonable probability of being able to meet her income goals along the way. Here's a few slides that show the same sort of things but with the mortality pool concept in place. You can see here that this is the black lines are just the allocated pension. You can see the probability of meeting her income goals falls off in, you know, with or without the mortality pool, but it starts to pick up a little bit here at the end. The modest lifestyle that APRA have sort of is something that's quite easy to provide for this person. and for Jane. And you can see here the income structure for the median scenario. So mostly it's the age pension. There's a bit coming from the allocated pension, dropping off out to age 88. Mortality pool starting to kick some payments in, but income really does drop off from age 88. So it's not quite as strong. And there are other ways to design this so that maybe you can get more income at the later ages, which might be a good thing if you combine the guarantee and the mortality pool with a slightly different structure. You could potentially do it in a way that you can sort of maximise the income at these ages. Similar sort of graph there. There's nothing much new in that. So in summary, I think number one is, and then I'll do a little summary and then we can open it up for questions. So summaries are, you know, the current challenges are low interest rates. They're not really low historically. Currently they're sort of pretty close to historical averages, but they are much lower than the 80s, 70s and 80s, which has been a formative experience for a lot of retirees. So that they could go much lower than they are now. They could get down to the Japanese levels. All our projections there have been done assuming a 0% interest rate. And, you know, there are, you know, low interest rates have caused a lot of issues in other markets where there are strong guarantees. So they do undermine the life insurer's profitability. But in Australia, we, you know, it's the retirees that are actually bearing the risk. So there's probably room for the insurers to step in and provide a bit more protection, as long as we do it responsibly and manage those guarantees tightly. It's unclear whether the future will see interest rates rise from current average levels to more longer term, more palatable levels of 5 or 6%. Certainly the Trump election did cause a bit of an increase in interest rates in this first part of this year, but that seems to be backing off a little bit. There are alternative investment vehicles available at the moment, so those first generation ones, which do help clients sort of move their income from interest income to more risky dividend income or capital growth income from risky assets, and potentially to pool their investment with other people that they feel a sense of solidarity for. The real challenge, I think, is because none of these products sell particularly well in Australia, despite the fact that Australians have all this interest rate risk on their personal balance sheet and longevity risk on their personal balance sheet. So there's a whole lot of, you know, things that have to change in the way we communicate with clients, I think, in some way. And, you know, I mean, the way we've tried to communicate this here, it may not be appropriate, but in some ways we need to be able to get people to understand the range of possible outcomes that they're facing and help them to make those risk trade-offs that can be made. So that's about it. Yep. So we can open it up for questions, explanations.
Thank you, Mark and Nick. Yes, so if you have any questions, if you could step up to the microphone and state your name before asking a question. Before you go up, I did have one question myself, actually, which I thought I'd just sort of kick it going, which is, you talked about these products aren't selling. You talked a little bit about that things need to change. Have you got any suggestions of what needs to change, or is it more amorphous than a few specific actions?
Yeah, I've got a few suggestions. I think number one, that we have to, people need to understand what risks they're actually facing. And so we need to be able to communicate that risk in a way that will make sense to people. And then the products that we sell need to be simplified, or try to sell, need to be simplified to address particular concerns that people actually have. So one particular concern that we think exists is, you know, this concept of sequencing risk. If you retire, say you're, you know, I don't know, 55 and you want to retire at 60, and you've got a certain amount of money now and you think, oh, well, I'm pretty close to being ready to retire. You get to 60, you're making all those plans to retire at 60, and then you have a GFC type event, you lose 50% of your money. You can't really retire at that point, so those plans get shelved. If you could, using a guarantee, you could actually sort of make those plans a little bit more solid, because you'd know you'd have at least that much money, you know, $500,000 or whatever it is that you've got set aside. So that if you can make these products more specific to a particular goal and risk that someone is concerned about, it may help to help the advisors understand what's going on, and also the client to understand and make the choice to pay the extra premium. And I think the platform fees have to come down a bit too. So.
Just to add on to that. I think another thing is a lot of people don't always recognise the value of such products. And something that I think I saw in the financial system inquiry was the concept of group self-annuitisation, which I think is pretty much very similar to the way this pool is designed. And it's sort of like designing an opt-out system for annuitisation, like we use in group insurance. And I think that's another way we could sort of boost the use of these products.
Colin Grenfell. Mark, it's most informative, and I'm interested in how you can communicate this to the end user. Could you put up the chart that showed an item called median scenario? There's a few charts, but any of them, just that shows this
that
median
there?
Scenario.
Yep.
Yeah, that'll do. I'm looking at the bottom right-hand one there.
Mm-hmm.
What is the median scenario? Is it the median of a whole lot of scenarios, or is it a single scenario which has been chosen as the median based on some criteria?
So I'll just say a few words about that. I mean, this is one of the issues that you face with these sort of stochastic projections, as you would know well, Colin. When you're looking at 1,000 scenarios, do you take the cross-sectional distribution or the longitudinal distribution? And in this case, I think what we've done is to take the cross-sectional distribution at year 10 and say this was the median result or median asset value at that time, and then project the actual scenario, so the full longitudinal scenario. There are other ways to do that. Does that make sense? It's a whole other slide.
Is it a single scenario?
Yeah, that's a single scenario.
Okay.
And we've chosen that single scenario based on the median at age 72, I think, yeah.
I think it was based on, the median time at which their account runs out of money.
Yeah.
I think that's a great way of
doing it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't like the other way of doing it, because it sort of hides what might actually happen to someone.
So I have a quick question regarding those guaranteed products. Does the insurance company do any hedging against those risks associated with the guaranteed products?
Yes. Well, you don't have to. An insurance company would need to look at their risk management framework and sort of assess their risk appetite and determine, you know, how they would want to manage the risks associated with providing a guarantee in line with that risk appetite. Historically, those types of products, not all insurance companies have hedged the investment risk. But since the GFC, I don't think you would find any insurance company trying to run one of these products without hedging, hedging pretty much all of the financial risks, so interest rate risk and equity market risk, both first and second order.
So is an insurance company interested in active trading rather than beyond the level of hedging required by providing those guaranteed products in order to achieve higher profits in general?
It depends on the insurance company. Yeah. I know that at AMP we do run one of these products, and we're not trying to take investment risk to enhance profits. We're trying to hedge out all of the financial risk.
That's it. Thank you.
Steve DeFina. This is probably more of a comment than a question. Really enjoyed the presentation, particularly the world view at the start, and that sort of made it clear to me that there's a lot of people having the same issues, just coming from different angles. There are areas of the world where they've had a history of guarantees, and I think in Australia that's less the case. And there's going to be an interesting time coming forward, I think, not only in terms of product and evolution to try and meet people's needs, but also, I think, from some of the other stuff that's been happening here today and yesterday around how these things fit in with social frameworks and legal frameworks and trying to provide a more holistic solution for people as they try and grapple with all the different risks of retirement. So thanks for the paper.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the comment. Are there any other questions?
Quick one. It's Kevin from Challenger. Thanks for the presentation. I think this is also something we look at in Challenger as well, where it's different products and layered together. One quick question on put products. I think you said it's providing 5% capital drawdown after age 85. I don't think that's a really sensible result because you need a 20-year payback period after 85. So essentially, it deferred with another 20 years. Also on the GSAs, I think GSAs without guarantees wouldn't provide a really sensible result to protect the retirement needs. So what's your view on that?
So I just didn't catch that last comment. The GSA...
Without any guarantees, I don't think that will provide a good value for the customer to meet the retirement needs.
Yeah, so you're referring to the guarantees around the investment risks associated with it, or
guarantees
the longevity?
Around investment, guarantee around longevity, I think.
Yeah.
If you're just pulling a pool of lives and let it run down, I'm not sure whether the payment amount every year as you draw down will really meet the needs.
Yeah.
Also, I think the industry have quite a range of benchmarks against the retirement needs. Some research has suggested that a normal GSA wouldn't really meet any other benchmark at all.
Yeah, so I would agree with you that, I mean, the pooling concept here doesn't really provide you any guarantee that the pool's mortality experience won't further weaken. You know, so people just keep living longer and longer, and so your income is reduced as a result. So this is I think someone talked about that yesterday at one of the sessions. You could get into the situation where people are not getting much of a distribution from the pool, and their expectations are not being met.
If nobody else has got a question, I've got one more, which I was sort of just thinking about. One of the themes that we're getting through this summit this time is social responsibility and thinking differently. Are there any lessons that we can learn from Japan where they sort of have legislated minimum earning rates or guarantees where to bring them back if there was a sort of government-private sector partnership type of approach? Or do you think that's just too far a stretch for current governments?
Do you want to answer that one?
I don't really know much about that specific issue, but Yeah, I just know that the Japanese government did intervene and allow them to reduce their guaranteed rates. But, I wasn't aware of, like, public and private partnerships in that area. But it could be an interesting area to explore, I think.
So something like the minimum surrender values in life insurance, where there is a legislated minimum interest rate built into it, I mean, that is, I would have thought the government would be able to, should be able to, if they're going to legislate a minimum, they should be able to change that minimum as events unfold. But I personally would have prefer the government not to be legislating minimum interest rates. It's sort of pushing a risk into the private sector that they're not really able to then manage. But I guess you would expect me to say that. Okay.
Well, I think the bell has gone a number of times. The door is about to open. So if you could join me and thank our presenters.